From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The year was 1971. Hendrix and Joplin were dead. Morrison was on his way. Nixon was in the White House. Vietnam was a swamp. And the Rolling Stones were in self-imposed exile on the French Riviera. Keith Richards and Mick Jagger in a psycho standoff in a chateau drowning in sex and drugs, they rolled out tracks for what many consider to be one of their greatest albums. Writer Robert Greenfield was there this hour on Point, Exile on Main Street and the Rolling Stones. You can join the conversation. Why are these rockers, the Rolling Stones, still far and away the biggest box office draw on the planet? And what do you hear in the dark disarray of 1971? Listening back from 2006, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Pacific Grove, California, at NPR member station KAZU, is writer Robert Greenfield. He wrote Dark Star, an oral biography of Jerry Garcia, and Timothy Leary, a biography. He was with the Stones in France in 1971 and chronicled the tour that followed. His new book is titled Exile on Main Street, A Season in Hell with the Rolling Stones. Robert Greenfield, thanks so much for being with us.
That's my great pleasure.
So here we are, before we even get to the history, I mean, these remarkable, what, grandpappies now, out on the road, you report, likely to gross twice as much as the next biggest band in this year, 2006, $147.3 million, U2 coming in second at a mere $73 million. How can these craggy geezers keep this going? What is it about the Rolling Stones after all these years that has them still sitting on that big bank, Robert Greenfield?
Well, I also did a book titled Bill Graham Presents, My Life Inside Rockin' Out, with Bill Graham, who was the greatest rock promoter. And if he was still with us, what Bill would have said is if they weren't any good, no one would go see them. The ticket prices are extraordinary, but it seems that no one leaves feeling they've been cheated. The Stones are still a great live band. That was always the basis of their attraction. The albums are not what they used to be, but they are able to draw capacity crowds to baseball stadiums in an era when no one else can.
You followed them for many years. Way back in 1972, you were on tour with them and wrote about in your book, STP. But here you are taking us back to 1971. Why have you put your fork in here? I mean, you were at the Chateau, you were at the Riviera with them. That's a pretty good beginning. But what is it about this album, this time, this place, and what happened with the Stones there that drew your eye?
Well, you know, if I could answer that question, I wouldn't have written a book about it. And I'm not trying to be more obnoxious than I usually am, but it's a really good question. And the really good questions don't, you know, always generate a flip mm-hmm. or an easy answer. Mm-hmm. I think I always wanted to write about this, and I think what makes the book different, and, you know, there have been some reviews, some folks get it and some folks don't, which really is the way it is in rock and roll. It's about going back in my own life 35 years and looking at who I was back then in that context. Now, I'm not in the book at all, but I think if you consider the way the fact that the Stones are on the road tonight, as we're speaking,
yeah.
they're out there still. So they become kind of an
amazing.
Absolute barometer. It is. It becomes an absolute barometer as to how the world and the United States has changed in the period between 1971 and 2006. And that's really what the book is about. The book is bookended. The last part of it is about the way they are now. And there's almost no relationship between the way they live their lives and, more importantly, the world in which they live their lives.
Take us back to 1971 first, just in terms of kind of history and rock and roll history. We'll come to the Stones, but set the stage for us. What was this moment, this cultural moment, wherein you're going to take us off to the south of France?
I think what it was really was a turning point. And what was happening and people who were alive at that point, you never know what's going on around you while it's going on. what had been the counterculture was not nearly dead, but it was approaching terminal illness, okay? And the 60s
were... Talking the 60s and how ripe that had become. Yeah. What were the markers of that decline?
Well, the markers of the decline, I mean, the first thing I would say is what's extraordinary about the 60s is how these five Englishmen, you know, who were truly English back then, the albums that preceded Exile, which were the great trio, Beggar's Banquet, Let It Bleed, and Sticky Fingers, the Stones were so plugged into the zeitgeist, especially in America then, that these albums, which were coming out from a band that lived so far away and only toured sporadically in America during those years, they were anticipating the changes that were going on in the culture. When, you know, Mick Jagger went to an anti-war demonstration in Grosvenor Square in London, and then he wrote Street Fighting Man, and that became an anthem for all the political radicals in America. So they had been so in touch with what was going on in the counterculture at that point. They had toured in 69, which ended at Altamont, which a lot of people like to point to as the end of the counterculture, which it most certainly was not. But then this exile, this metaphysical exile, and it was nothing in rock is really metaphysical. It was it's all about money. It was a tax exile because they couldn't afford to live in England anymore. They found themselves thrown together on the French Riviera, which the writer W. Somerset Maugham once described as a sunny place for shady people. And they belonged there. I mean, they really fit, okay. But they were in a situation they'd never found themselves before. They were living with one another and really not talking or dealing with anybody else. And they didn't come there with an album ready to be recorded. That's not the way the Stones functioned back then. They kind of got in the studio and saw what happened, which is the way Keith liked to work.
They weren't entirely alone. You describe a whole coterie of people around them. Just to place it, I mean, here we are in 1971. This is after big hits like Brown Sugar and You Can't Always Get What You Want and Jumpin' Jack Flat. This is what before a lot of things that would come, Ain't Too Proud to Beg, Fool to Cry, Beast of Burden, mm-hmm. and Ride On Down. You say their exile was in part a tax exile. They were trying to escape those big UK taxes. But it was also a metaphysical exile, as you describe it in the book. What was the Stone sort of mental moment here?
Well, the mental moment comes from Keith. And I think earlier in his life and career, in the summer of 1966, he had hung out with Brian Jones and Anita Pallenberg in the flat they lived in London. And it was a very communal scene, as many were back then. And Keith seemed to like that. He liked to have people around him. So now he had an extraordinary house by the sea, which was the name of the house was Villa Nelcutt, mm-hmm. and it was in Villa France, looking over this fabulous deep water harbor. It had been built by a banker who had brought trees from all over the world. It was an extraordinary storybook, F. Scott Fitzgerald kind of a place. It's definitely Tender as the Night. So through the house came John and Yoko Ono Lennon, Graham Parsons, various dealers, various sons of aristocrats, various nefarious human beings who seemed to be doing something for a living, but in fact were just hanging out at what I say was like the epicenter of the hip world. And in this kind of a situation, they somehow expected that they would be able to record an album. And because Keith had become very difficult to schedule and often did not show up. Well, I was on the tour that they did before they left England in March of that year. And I can say absolutely he did not arrive on time for a single gig, nor did he travel with anybody else. The Stones at that point, they all traveled together. They got on these trains and they sat in compartments. It was very human. It hadn't gotten huge and corporate yet. But even at that point, Keith, he was on his own planet, to put it kindly. So they came up with the brilliant idea of why don't we record this album in the basement of this mansion, which turned out to be probably one of the worst ideas in the history of rock and roll.
Did they have a sense of themselves in history at that time? I mean, things were still pretty early. They'd had a lot of success, but it wasn't into the mega years yet. And as you remind us, Hendrix was dead, Joplin was dead, Jim Morrison would soon be dead later in 1971.
He actually died that summer as they were recording the album.
Right. Did the Stones have a sense of themselves in that swirl? Were they thinking, my God, what's happening to our ranks?
You know, that's a really good question, Tom. And what I would say to you, here's what's extraordinary about these guys, and anybody who wants to slag them, as the English say, you know, is to ignore how hard they worked as a band, which is they had been in existence for about 7 years by 1971. They had recorded 18 albums and had 31 singles, many of which had gone to number one in both America and in England. Excuse me. However, because they also had signed some nefarious and very difficult business deals, they had absolutely no money. They were literally broke, okay? And they couldn't access the money that was coming in from their previous recordings because they were in litigation. So to answer your question, I think, A, they had no idea of their own standing in the history of rock because nobody cared about rock and roll back then. Nobody was writing
about it. In 1971, nobody cared about rock and roll?
The only people who cared about it were the kids who came to see them play and the ones who bought the albums. I mean, when I wrote STP, A Journey Through America with the Rolling Stones, in 72, came out in 73, was the first full-length book account of a rock and roll tour. Rock and roll was outlaw stuff. It was not, you know, their albums were reviewed, certainly, in the New York Times.
Everybody was aware. It sure seemed mainstream to me. I mean, kids all over the country were like, well, we'll look at it. Robert Greenfield, with us from Pacific Grove, California today. Please stand by. The new book is Exile on Main Street, A Season in Hell with the Rolling Stones, and we'll look at that hell. We'll go out here with a cut from Exile on Main Street. This is Casino Boogie. You can join our conversation. Where were you in 71? Are you still listening to the Rolling Stones? We're at 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Rolling Stones' seminal album Exile on Main Street with author Robert Greenfield. The American musician Graham Parsons was among the Stones' entourage right in the middle of it, hanging out in 1971 at the Villa Nelcote. Parsons had a major impact on the Rolling Stones and introduced them to his brand of country folk music. The song Sweet Virginia was a direct result of that influence. There it is, a little bit country and a little bit rock and roll, 1971, in a very strange place on the south coast of France. You can join us in our conversation with Robert Greenfield this hour. His new book is Exile on Main Street, A Season in Hell with the Rolling Stones. Are you still listening to the Stones? And what is it about the Rolling Stones that keeps them rolling into their 60s? Jagger and Richards, both now 63 years old. 800-423-8255 is our number. It's 800-423-TALK. Robert Greenfield, you remind us that this one was not actually recorded in that chateau cellar, as I read you, but that influence of Graham Parsons was certainly there, and he was part of the crowd coming and going that summer. I wish you'd take us into the heart of this circle of people, the Stones themselves and the people around them. Just first go to Keith Richards. He's your hero, your anti-hero in this story. Describe him as you find him in 1971.
Well, when you meet famous people, sometimes they're less than you think. And Keith at that point, and I think Mick as well in a different way, were very, very charismatic, very powerful. And Keith was an authentic artist in that he was living the outlaw lifestyle. He truly was committed to what he was doing. He really only cared mostly about his music. He was constantly playing, except when they needed him to be in the studio when they were recording. And I just found him someone who, at that point in time, embodied the values of this culture that was about to come to an end.
Hero, anti-hero. How did he play it both ways?
Well, he played it both ways because I think a real artist embodies both ends of every spectrum. I mean, you know, James Joyce once said that what an artist needs is exile, cunning, and silence. And I think Keith had the exile and the cunning, and I don't know. He did have the silence as well. Up to that point in time, before he did, I was staying in the house with him to do the Rolling Stone interview, and he had never really spoken. And so 7 years on, he had been completely silent, and as somebody points out in the book, because Mick had always been the front man and had taken all the heat, it had allowed Keith to develop as a musician and an artist and a human being. I mean, most of what Keith went through to that point in time was not in the newspaper. And I think that's the difference between the way it is now and the way it was then.
But you describe Keith Richards here feeling really, at some level, confident in himself, unvarnished, not like Mick, who's got all kinds of varnish, and we'll talk about that. But this is also a Keith Richards, you know, who's got a knife and a gun and a needle always awfully close at hand, deep in the heroin and all kinds of craziness there on the Riviera.
Well, you know, we're all products of our environment. I hate to sound like a sociologist, but we all reflect our own experiences. And I think where Keith begins with all that is first time the Stones come to America, I believe it's 1964. They're playing either in Kansas or Oklahoma or at the Texas State Fair. Keith is backstage. He's drinking a Coke. And some huge state trooper comes in and says to him, "Dump that whiskey and Coke down the toilet, boy." Keith's not accustomed to being spoken this way, and he's very English, and he says, "It's not whiskey." The trooper pulls out this huge revolver, points it at Keith, and instructs him to pour whatever he's drinking down the toilet. Keith does so, and the next day he goes to a pawn shop, and he buys himself a gun. So that was his introduction to America. And the thing about the Stones is, and was, they were always influenced by America, and a lot of what they got and a lot of what they became was what they saw when they would come over here back then.
Now, Richards, Keith Richards, you describe as being very conscious in a way of the counterculture, as seeing himself in some sense as defining it. A man, I mean, he may have been a working class kid, but he was determined not to live by, you know, what they would disparagingly refer to in those days as bourgeois norms. He was very upfront about it.
Right, but I don't think that relates to the counterculture. I think that relates to his desire to be an artist and the fact that he had gone to art school, lasted for a couple years, had always really done nothing but play music. It's not the same now as it was back then. I mean, these guys were making it up as they went along, and while they weren't enshrined by mainstream culture, they were surrounded by people who considered them to be artists, and that's all you really need.
And that was quite a worshipful crew and a wild one. Out of this hothouse comes what you call Keith Richards' signature tune, Happy. What do we listen for? And we'll hear a bit of it. What should we listen for in this? What are you pointing to, Robert Greenfield?
Well, what's extraordinary about this song is they've been sitting and playing night after night. They've been jamming in this horrible, dark, humid, hot basement. They're not coming up with any kind of music. I think Mick is off on his honeymoon at this point. And Keith walks into the studio to warm up. And he's written this song basically because he just learned that Anita is pregnant. So that's what happened. And Happy becomes his signature tune.
Let's listen to Happy from Exile on Main Street, 1971. Keith Richards and Happy, 1971. He needs a love to keep him happy. But you write, essentially just wants to keep on rocking until they have to pry his cold, dead fingers from the neck of his guitar. Not for him, you write, Robert Greenfield, the wealth, fame, and social standing that Mick Jagger seems to crave so deeply. Give us that portrait of Mick Jagger this same summer, dark summer, 1971.
Well, Mick has already become part of not the mainstream, but the A-list jet set. He is befriended by, you know, people who belong to the House of Lords. He moves in social circles with the Guinnesses, and he's always a guest in someone's great house. And he likes this. I mean, he's grown up a lot more middle class than Keith has. Keith, likes to play with that stuff, but when it really comes down to it, he's much more comfortable in the street, so to speak. And maybe that's because that's where he has to go to score. And, you know, I'm not saying it's the drugs, but the essence of the book, one of the themes that runs through it, is this incredibly complicated relationship between Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, which, after all is said and done, has probably resulted in more music than any other quote-unquote songwriting combination in history.
Michael Philip Jagger, Mick Jagger, and for all of Keith Richards' sort of larger-than-life sort of dark side, Mick Jagger's the one about whom you say, what a piece of work. What do you mean?
Well, because he is the ultimate game player. And an amazing control freak, and someone who spent a year at the London School of Economics, and had he never picked up a mouth harp or ever sang the blues, he probably still would be the CEO of a huge corporation making an incredible amount of money. I mean, I don't think there's ever been an artist, and Mick is an artist, and he is, along with Bono of U2, probably the greatest stage performer in the history of rock and roll, who's ever been better at doing business. It's not an accident that the Stones have this much money. It's because of Mick.
Marianne Faithfull, the 60s beauty, and then his wife, and then not.
Not his wife. Sorry, Tom.
One of his loves, excuse me. That's right.
Sorry.
Of the many. Pardon me. That's right.
Right, there you go.
She wrote about him. There's nothing truly, of course, marriage so passe then, but not ultimately. and we'll talk about it. She wrote, there's nothing truly mythic or tragic about Mick. He's too normal, too sane. I mean, this is a London School of Economics guy who's out there in those short, tight pants doing the big dance.
Well, and as you know, that's funny you said what you said, because the great shocking news of that summer, and it's the only rock event that makes one of those day-by-day books from the decades from that year, is the fact that he chooses to get married. And no one can now understand how devastating this was. And it wasn't because, oh, we're losing our teen idol. It was that he was selling out. People said, well, why would you get married? And I think that was Keith's attitude as well.
Was marriage itself selling out, or was it Bianca, who became Bianca Jagger, and marrying her that was selling out? What?
Keith and Anita had a child named Marlon. They weren't married. You know, it's like marriage was what other people did. You know, it's like they were beyond these conventions. Why would you be married? But, you know, this was where Mick was going in his life. And as he proved after this, he got married again.
and of course, he and Bianca, you remind us, marched down the aisle, not to anything like Rolling Stones music, but to theme music from the movie Love Story. Talk about the opposite of the Stones. Meanwhile, back at the mansion, they're writing Tumbling Dice from Exile on Main Street. Let's get that in our ears. A love story of a different sort, Tumbling Dice from Exile on Main Street. Robert Greenfield is with us. He was there. His new book, Exile on Main Street, A Season in Hell with the Rolling Stones. Jeannie's calling from Wallingford, Connecticut. Hi, Jeannie. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Very well. What do you hear, Jeannie? What do you recall?
Well, I just wanted to say that I've been a fan since 1965, and I saw them at the New Haven Arena.
Yeah.
In 1965, and there was absolutely no one there. I'm sure they hadn't caught on, and I could have reached out and touched Mick Jagger, really. And I was just interested in their music. It had a rhythm and blues kind of foundation, and I think that's what attracted me to it. And it was absolutely unheard of back then. In fact, they used to have a program on one of the radio stations called The Scene of the Unheard, and that's the only place that I could ever hear any of this type of music. So I just wanted to say that I've been a fan of theirs, and I'm glad that you have this
program.
Are you
still, Jeannie, is it still moving you after all these years?
Well, actually, when they kind of got commercialized and more pop culture, I kind of withdrew from it a little. But I was really interested in the first couple albums when they were doing things like Tell Me and Little Red Rooster and things like that. That was really, really, I found very interesting.
Jeannie, we love it, and thanks for your call. There's a lot to talk about with the music itself here. The R&B, you write, Robert Greenfield, kind of when everything else fell apart between these two guys, when the tensions were huge over women and drugs and money and composing and all the rest, R&B was the thing that held them together.
Well, you know, I really take Jeannie's point. I'm glad you took that call, because what's extraordinary about these guys is they're growing up in England, which is completely separate from the United States back then. They're growing up completely English, post-World War II English. And somehow they hear this music. They hear Elmore James, and they hear Robert Johnson, and they hear Muddy Waters. And Mick, who has more money than Keith, he starts sending away for records from Chess Records in Chicago. And then, you know, 15 years later, Marshall Chess becomes the president of their record label. And the first or second time they come to America, they record at Chess Records. And that's the song 2020 Michigan Avenue, which is the address of Chess. And the first time they ever see Brian Jones, he's playing Elmore James stuff. Now, the question is, how is it possible that people from such a different culture are not only able to understand this music, but then recreate it in a way that really is the beginning of rock and roll? What rock and roll is about, and it's great we talked about Graham Parsons, It's the mixing of black music and white people doing black music, country musicians playing white and black music, and it's that's where the energy and the vitality come from, and that's what the Stones were geniuses at, mixing it all together.
Did they credit the black artists, the American artists, that they really just kind of took straight off? I mean, Robert Johnson stopped breaking down. As I recall, they just took that, did it, didn't credit him, and off they went to glory. Did they credit the originals?
Well, they didn't. On Exile, that's credited to traditional and arranged by them. And they also do Hip Shake by Slim Harpo. I can't account for the actual physical credit. They always knew whose songs they were doing. On the 72 tour, I wonder if there are people out there who were there, they would do Love in Vain every night acoustic, which is another Robert Johnson song. So you'll find right from the beginning, they were doing, as she said, Little Red Rooster. They always played black blues.
Let's take a call from Mark in West Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hello.
Good day, sir.
I may have attended the same show as your previous caller from Connecticut, Jeannie, did.
You were rocking out in New Hampshire?
New Haven, Connecticut.
Oh, New Haven. Okay,
yeah,
right.
Get Off of My Cloud was their current hit.
Right.
It cannot be stressed enough how incredible they were at that time. They opened up at Everybody Needs Somebody to Love, the Solomon Burke tune.
Nice.
And like Bill Wyman once said, back then we didn't play shows or concerts. We played riots or near riots. Secondly, I disagree that Exile is that good. For one thing, the sound quality is lousy.
That basement on the Riviera.
Brian Jones was no longer around.
He had died, yep.
And he literally named the group after the Muddy Waters tune. Mm-hmm. I'm jumping around a little bit. But one of the key contributions they made, and of course there were so many, is they introduced white Americans to their own heritage, i.e. Muddy, Bo, Chuck, etc. Another last comment is that currently 9 out of 10 Rolling Stones so-called fans cannot name a tune by them prior to Satisfaction. They never heard of Empty Heart. They never heard of Mona. They don't know.
There's the old one true fan speaking. Mark, we've got it. Thanks for your call. You know,
Tom, that guy's hardcore, Tom.
Hardcore, okay. True believer, right there next to Jeannie, shaking the hip in the 60s and still listening today.
Can I just say one thing about what he said? Which is, you know, I can't disagree with his critical assessment of Exile on Main Street. What I find interesting is, and he is from the generation who saw them in 65, if you talk to people who are 25 and 26 years old, Exile's the album that they think is the Stones' masterpiece, and it continues to sell. It just speaks to people in a different way.
We'll come back and look at that. Here's one, Just Want to See His Face, a little Time for Religion on the Riviera, talking about Jesus. Robert Greenfield is with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And RHR International, an executive and organizational development firm committed to integrating executives into new roles.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the Rolling Stones in self-imposed exile in France in 71. From that time, here's Stop Breaking Down, the Robert Johnson tune. Go the well-bred London boy, London School of Economics, Mick Jagger, picking up on deep American rhythm and blues, building something great again with it. Robert Greenfield is with us this hour. He was there in Villefranche on the south coast of France, the Riviera, 1971, watching the Rolling Stones, meltdown. And we'll look at it, hearing what came out of it. You can join the conversation. Does an album created by strung-out British musicians in exile in France capture the mood of America in the early 1970s? Are you still following the Stones? Can you imagine the next Keith Richards or Mick Jagger coming out of American Idol or Rock Star Supernova? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Robert Greenfield, you write about the very different styles of getting down to the music that Keith Richards and Mick Jagger had and the tension that came out of that. Remind us of how they approached it.
Well, Mick liked everything to be taken care of before he sat down in the studio, which, in terms of the way the world works now, makes eminent sense. Keith, on the other hand, liked to just get there and kind of start playing a riff or a groove and see if he could get a song out of it. Now, if you're paying for studio time, that's really not the way you want to make an album, right? Or record a record. But Keith believed in spontaneity, and that's why I loved playing with Gram Parsons so much. They would just sit there together, make up songs, play together, sing, and see what came out. Mick worked the other way, so there was that kind of tension between them right from the very beginning.
He said way back, "I can't sit around on a song for too long. I like to get in the studio and write it there. Mick, on the other hand, likes to have it all worked out and rehearsed before he goes in. That's the basic difference between us. I get bored quicker." But he didn't even go in with a lick of these songs in his head. He must have had a kind of notion before he came up with some of these.
You know, it's really hard to know how people like this function. I mean, when I did the Jerry Garcia book, Garcia was very much the same way. I mean, there's a story in this book told by Andy Johns, who was the engineer. They went to Jamaica after this to record Goat's Head Soup. And Andy saw Keith asleep in bed with his guitar. And even he thought, you know, enough. But that's where they're living. They're living in their music. There's no difference. You know what I mean? It's like that's what they're about. And that's not what Mick was about. Mick was about Mick. He had a life, you know, outside of that. And where the music comes from in Keith, that's the stuff that nobody can explain.
So there's the basic difference in how they approached it. Mick as the lyrics guy. But then, in this particular summer, take us on into this, you could cut it with a knife, tension between these two men, the women, the money issues, but especially the women. I was really struck at what a huge role and influence the relationships with women away from the microphones had on what came through the microphones.
Well, you know, both Mick and Keith were tutored in how to be a rock star by Brian Jones, who was already dead at this point in time. And what Brian taught them is, no woman will ever come between the Rolling Stones, which led to them sharing and passing women around, and forgive me for being sexist, but that's what they did. The subtext of the conflict here is that during the fall and winter of 1968, Mick Jagger and Anita Pallenberg filmed a movie entitled Performance, which I don't know if anyone's seen that lately, but at the time it was considered so shocking that it wasn't released for 2 years. And this is something that I cannot explain even now, and no one understands, because Mick was living with Marianne Faithfull. Mm. Marianne Faithfull and Anita were the best of friends. Keith and Anita were living together. Mick then had an affair during the filming of the movie with Anita. Everybody knew about this. Keith was quite upset. And then the four of them went off on holiday together to South America, and Mick and Keith wrote Honky Tonk Women.
Mm. But the thing you describe, but you describe something that's not just random about that, the kind of determination not to live by social norms as they were handed to them. So they, you know, when these sort of off the range relationships emerged, they had a hard time complaining to each other about them because they were supposed to be outlaws.
Well, they never complained. It's another really good point and an excellent question in the sense that they were outlaws, but they were English. And back then, and I lived there for several years in London, one never confronted anyone else about anything. It just wasn't done. There was none of this therapeutic venting and sharing. That's not what they were doing. They would slag each other behind closed doors. It was all under the cover of the night, as I say. And what it did, it served actually to ratchet up the pressure and the tension, and that was the cauldron out of which this album emerged. It was simmering all the time.
But Keith Richards had a lot of leverage emotionally on Mick Jagger here. He could leave him standing in that sweltering Riviera cellar waiting to record while Keith was upstairs with the needle or you name it, and Mick just had to, for once in his life, couldn't control the scene.
Well, you know, I think the best analogy, and it's great that people who have called have seen them and saw them then, is anyone who saw them in that era, if you saw the way Mick and Keith were on stage, you would get immediately the difference between them. In other words, as brilliant as Mick was, and he is a great performer, it is a performance. Keith looked like they'd just let him out of a cage. In other words, if you weren't frightened by what Keith was doing on stage, you weren't paying attention. It was real, you know, and it was different every night back then. And that's who they are as human beings. And, you know, you need one of each to make the mix that is the Rolling Stones.
Let me take a call from Whitestone, Virginia. George, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, and thank you to your guests. I have to tell you, I was born in 1976, so this is a little post when that album was created. But I was fortunate enough, my dad took me and my three siblings to see the Rolling Stones, 1989, Steel Wheels, RFK Stadium. And the one thing that sticks out in my mind is the song Honky Tonk Woman. And on that tour, there were two large inflatable women that just inflated from either side of the stage. And the roar that came over the crowd was unmatchable. I've been to many musical concerts, and none has topped that. But what's important is in the 80s is when Mick was using all his economics. That's when they were building their empire, was for all the tours that they were doing through the 80s.
He turned out to be a heck of a businessman. Maybe that London School of Economics education came on strong, but now we hear the story about the surround of Honky Tonk Woman. Robert Greenfield, the inflatable women kind of takes us to, I mean, here to this. On the one hand, you've got women surrounding and influencing them hugely. On the other hand, there's the charge of misogyny around the Stones. Were they working out their frustration with women in their music?
You know, it's another really good question. If I, you know, I look back at the interview I did with Keith in 1971, which almost it's kind of pre-women's liberation. And one of the questions I asked him was, you know, do the Stones hate women? Why are there so many songs like Stupid Girl? And, you know, and his response was, well, we were surrounded by a bunch of women who basically weren't that, you know, elevated or liberated or fabulous to be around. Anita, the effect of Anita Pallenberg on this album and the albums that precede it cannot be overestimated. She and Brian Jones were absolutely the first alpha rock couple. Now, all the ones that have followed are basically just, you know, copies of the original. They're the first. They dressed like one another. They wore one another's clothes. They were fashion icons. And it's extraordinary. I mean, she leaves Brian before he dies, and then she's with Keith, and she's been with Mick. I mean, as I say in the book, she considered herself a Rolling Stone and had a lot to do with the way they dressed, acted, and conducted themselves in this era, whereas the last caller, you know, really, you know, nailed it. It's not show business yet. It's becoming that. I mean, if you have inflatable women on stage, you know, you're in show business.
You're deep right? in show biz, but they had a very real woman, and you describe her as a woman of power. There's another woman associated with this album, Exile on Main Street, that takes us on into politics, which is another source of tension between Jagger and Richards. Richards never quite so into that. Jagger willing to go there. And that was Angela Davis, the black radical in the U.S., who was in the middle of all kinds of legal trouble back in these days. You've got a cut on this album, Sweet Black Angel, Mick Jagger's determination. Put it there. Let's listen.
Got a sweet black angel. Got a green old girl. Got a sweet black angel. Up above my wall. Well, she ain't no sing bop. She ain't no scar. But she sure does good. And she moves so fast. But the guy in danger. Yeah, the guy in chains. But you keep on pushing. What you think of this?
Robert Greenfield, here's a full embrace of politics. You couldn't have a more controversial figure at that time than this sweet black angel. And Mick Jagger saying she's his pinup gal.
Well, here's what's great about the Stones. The original name of that song was Bent Green Noodles. And it was recorded in Mick's home in Stargroves, his country estate, during the Sticky Finger session. Yeah. So at that point, obviously, these were not the words, because I don't think Angela was in prison yet. I actually remember being on the 72 tour when she was released and Jagger announced it to the crowd. But yeah, I mean, he absolutely saw her as a heroine who had been unjustly placed behind bars. And I mean, listen to the sound of this song. Nobody was making music like that back then. This doesn't sound like anything else that they ever did.
Funny, he came back with Sweet Neocon just in the last turn around the bend. Got political again on the most in the latest music out of the Stones, and controversy about that again. Even Keith Richards. We've got a little sound here of Keith Richards. This is September 2005, outside Boston's Fenway Park during the kickoff of the Stones' American concert. Very wary of Jagger's decision to introduce a political song on that last album about neocon. Specifically, he explained why he shies away from mixing music with politics.
Very rarely do we touch on political subjects, and I think some of the best ways we've done it is maybe things like Street Fighting Man and Sweet, you know, which are like more oblique. But I mean, this bunny wants to go face to face, fine. You know, I'm waiting for the counterattack.
Keith Richards with a different view. Let's get a call from Andrew in South Salem, New York. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hi. What do you see? What do you hear?
Well, you know what? I'm actually on my way down to Tower Records in Stamford, Connecticut, to go and buy some Stone CDs. And you know, I'm 36 years old, and I've been listening to them for, you know, not as long as you fellas have, but. You know, I really enjoy their music. I think they have amazing lyrical content. And I disagree with your previous caller saying that Exile on Main Street wasn't that great. I think it was amazing. And, you know, there's so much to be said about the Stones. You know, I don't know, you know, exactly where to begin or where to end.
Maybe all Mick would care. Well, I'm not sure all, but you're on your way to buy the record. that might do it, at least by Robert Greenfield's assessment. You know, we've got.
Tom, let me jump in. Yeah, can I jump in for a second? First of all, I would recommend that you take a look at Between the Buttons. Not a bad album, recorded long before
1960. Whoa, back there.
Yeah, 1960. Whoa, and then in terms of the little Keith clip that you played, which is always great to hear Keith talk. Think the, you know, that it's great that we've been talking about Mick and his dichotomous nature, if that is a word, because I think the best example of this is he writes a song called Sweet Neocon, and you can see the parallel between Angela Davis and Condoleezza Rice, and I won't even go there, okay? But he also accepts a knighthood. He's knighted by the Queen, and when he is, Keith Richards is so offended because the government has put them on trial and thrown them in jail, and Jagger accepts the knighthood, and Keith says, "You should have held out for the lordship. It's a paltry honor, mate," which is the essence of Keith.
Let's give Mick a little bit of his say. Here he is on this sweet neocon tune. Mick Jagger telling the BBC that the politics of the Bush administration are fair game.
My sweet neocon,
you know, with my feeling for these last 2-3 years of this kind of politics from a very small but very vociferous, powerful group of people.
Any one thing that sparked it off?
No, it wasn't one thing that sparked it off. I mean, I think you're always prepared to listen to people's points of view, but when you see that they're not working, I think you've got to speak up as well, you know.
Mick Jagger, it's muffled on the BBC there, but you can hear him willing to step into the politics. Robert Greenfield, how was this album received at the time? Everybody has their favorite Rolling Stones album, if they're a fan. What about this one when it rolled out?
I have to say about Mick's quote, I'd respect his position a lot more if he hadn't allowed one of President Bush's major supporters to sponsor the Bigger Bang Tour.
Okay? This is AmeriQuest, or I forget, what was it now? It's sort of big lender. Yeah, okay.
Who became the ambassador to some nation, the man who's the head of that, and poured an immense amount of money into getting Bush elected, and they sponsored the initial leg of the American Bigger Bang
Tour. You quote him saying they paid the most. You know, there's a bottom line here.
Say no more.
We've just got a minute. How was it received when it came out of exile?
There's a great myth that it was slammed when it came out, and they then became a mess. Masterpiece. That, in fact, is not true. A lot of people lauded it at the time as the greatest double album ever. They saw it as the Stones' masterpiece, but in fact, it confused people. There was so much music on it. It was mixed so densely that it was before its time. As somebody said, the 70s was being born in that house in the south of France, and it's such a dark album, and I'm afraid it's a dark book, that it took people a long time to really get it.
And on the other side of it, all done with counterculture, with the Stones, or still flying the flag?
Me or the Stones?
The Stones.
they are flying the flag of the Rolling Stones, and they actually have a gross national product which exceeds that of many small South American nations.
And Keith Richards, what is it, coming back? You remind us in Pirates of the Caribbean 3 with Johnny Depp as dad or grandpa or something?
I think. I think Keith is finally going to get to play himself.
Always a new way onto the stage. Robert Greenfield's book is Exile on Main Street, A Season in Hell with the Rolling Stones. You can read an excerpt of the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Robert Greenfield, thanks so much for being with us.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
We close with a cut from the Stones album, Exile on Main Street. This is Shine a Light.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.